Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, got a great show. Barry Thomas is our guest, and we're talking about how to do AOIP infrastructure right. Don't scrimp on these little things that can make a huge difference and could take you off the air. They're really important. Plus, what about C-band receiver registration? Turns out it's a pretty important thing. I didn't even know. Coming up on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twrt. And by the award-winning Telos Infinity IP intercom system. Plug and play, seamless, scalable, and matrix-free. Telos Infinity is the AOIP intercom solution that changes everything. Hey, everybody. Welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. This is the show where we talk about everything, you know, from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And for, I think, 4 years now, I've been promising to fix my light bulb and put it back here somewhere so you can see it. It's still in the garage. Yeah, like so many other projects. We got a great show for you today. First, I want to mention, though, that our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you by two amazing sponsors. One of them is Lavo. And the whole line of radio equipment and gear that they bring to the table, consoles, routing systems. And you want to check that out at Lavo, lavo.com/twrt. That'll take you right to the radio page, lavo.com/twrt. Also by the Telos Alliance at telosalliance.com. And there is no radio page. It's almost all radio page. They have some TV stuff as well from the TV Solutions Group. But it's a great website, easy to navigate, and you'll find lots of cool stuff there. And today we're going to be talking about the intercom system. The first intercom system is going into a radio station. The first IP intercom in the U.S. is going into a radio station. So that's going to be pretty cool. We'll talk about that in the coming weeks. All right. With me, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, in my office here. At my home, at my Telos office. Telos is my employer. And we're going to head on over to, I guess it's Newark. Are you in Newark? Chris Tobin, hello.
Yes, I am in Newark at a voice booth. Very bland-looking voice booth. But yes, I am in Newark, Newark, New Jersey.
Is that some soundproofing on the walls there? Sound detonator?
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's burlap bags from down in the iron-bound section, empty out potatoes, and we just put on some fiberglass and off we go. I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. we just built that radio station in Hawaii, and our man from Samoa is threatening to build some sound reduction, some, you know, panels, the way he did in Samoa, which is to he gets some the real heavy fiberglass insulation and then frames it with wood and wraps all that with Hawaiian or Samoan print material that he gets from the local shop. It's very colorful.
Well, yeah, it can work. I've actually done projects like that. You know, for surface treatment, you'd be surprised what you get away with. It's just the wall construction you have to really be concerned with. That's where the sound transmission takes place.
Yeah, yeah. In Hawaii, we're in what used to be an attorney's office, and it's nothing special about the construction whatsoever. So it's we'll get what we get. Hey, can you keep it down in there, please? I'm broadcasting. It's going to be a lot of that. I know there is. I just can you collect the garbage some other time, please?
We have problems now.
Luckily, we have microphones with aggressive audio processing and aggressive downward expansion. How about that?
So the
noise of the backing up garbage truck is modulated by the voice of the guy talking. Oh well. They're listening for the music. Hey, we've got a great guest with us this time. He's been on the show before. It's Barry Thomas from Denver. Yeah, from Denver. Come on in, Barry Thomas. From Denver. How are you?
What? Yeah, you were talking about, quiet. We're broadcasting. It reminds me of a Three Stooges drop. Quiet and unscripted on broadcasting.
Exactly. Exactly. We're glad to have Barry back. Barry, the first time you were on the show, you were broadcasting from your basement in Atlanta with what looked like a better studio than I've ever seen anywhere else before, except maybe at NPR. Tell me, is all that gone now?
I parted that out. Of course, I always manage to do this after I make big moves, after I move to Denver. But I found a a translator developer here, actually one of the one of the biggest translator developers in the middle of the country, and he had a bunch of stations and he had a need and he picked up every bit of it. It was an AMX console. I had full spares. It came out of the historic Star 94 in Atlanta. It was quite a nice setup, but trying to lighten the load a little bit. So now my studio setup is somewhat simpler, although it's still just as effective. It's just not as big. I kind of miss it, but in the grand scheme of things, it's doing better work right now.
Well, it's great to get us all together here, Chris and Barry, you two great broadcast engineers. And then there's me. I just kind of shuffle along and try to keep it going, learn from you guys. I have plenty of opinions on my own, but and I rarely keep them to myself. Barry, we've got some topics to discuss here. And by the way, we should mention, for those who don't know, Barry, I first met you years ago. You were working for a broadcast dealer and you showed me an audio console, it seems. Back at
that was when I was carrying around Harrison consoles in the back of a wood paneled Dodge Caravan.
Oh my gosh!
And I worked for the venerable Broadcasters General Store. They took a chance on a former chief engineer and taught me a whole lot about how to rep broadcast equipment. They were great to me, absolutely great.
Wow! Hey, and you know what? Sometime we should maybe do at least a little interview on the topic of how engineers should treat sales reps from companies like BGS or factory reps, because it's so easy to blow people off. Oh, they're just trying to sell me something. I know what I want. And hey gosh, we're all people. We got families to feed. And there's a function for people like you showing Harrison consoles around back 25 years ago, maybe more.
30-something.
Oh, gosh.
Wow. Let's just say I had longer hair and your hair wasn't white.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And now that Harrison console was made probably not far from where I live now in probably Smyrna, Tennessee.
That's right.
Yeah. The company's got a different name now. It's GLW, which stands for Good Lord Willing.
It changed while I was still driving around with an AP100 in the back of the van.
Wow. Wow. Well, I always heard good things about those consoles and a couple of bad things. A lot of capacitors to replace, it seems. But other than that,
and you could always on a Pro or Air 790, you could cook eggs really well on the Q amp.
And hence the need for capacitor replacement. That's right. And Barry, you served for a while as the president of the SBE, the elected president, right?
I did two terms as president of the Society of Broadcast Engineers, and of course, what comes with that is one or two terms as immediate past president, and then before that, served on the board and as a number of officers, and then after that, chaired their government relations committee for a few years.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a whole lot of meetings.
It was, but we did our advocacy work at the SBE was incredibly important, and there were a lot of things we needed to refine so that we better followed the exact purpose of the Society of Broadcast Engineers to support and advance broadcast engineers. And it's the only organization that actually has that as its specific mission. So we took that very seriously, even in our government advocacy.
Cool. And I know that and we'll get to our topics here in just a minute. In fact, I'll preview a little bit in this show when we get into the meat and potatoes of it. It's really going to be the Chris and Barry show, because you guys I haven't really prepped Chris on this much. But the topic really is building AOIP infrastructure. And Barry's going to basically talk about what mistakes I made so you don't have to. He's got some great advice on that. And Chris has built some AOIP facilities too. Of course, Chris built them all perfectly from the get-go and had no mistakes. Isn't that right,
Chris? Of course.
Well, it's like I always tell people, it's like a Broadway play. Until the curtain is drawn, it doesn't matter what happens on stage. When the curtain was drawn on those systems, yes, it was a perfect presentation, and everybody enjoyed it.
Well, before we get into that AOIP discussion, which is going to be really cool, those of you who have built, and in those of you who haven't built audio over IP facilities, it's the new now. I mean, it's here. If you're not on board on AOIP, you've got to be soon, because that's just where we are. That's where the technology is. But before, I wanted to mention that SBE What did I want to mention about SP? Oh, yeah, they're having their strategic planning conference coming up in, less than a couple weeks now. And I hope that a lot of, unfortunately, I can't go. So the Nashville SBE, where I'm a member of this chapter in Nashville, we elected to send our chapter chair to this meeting. And this kind of sets the course and the tone for SBE for the next 5 years. They do one of these meetings about every 5-6 years or so, and this will set the course. Barry, were you ever part of one of those strategic planning conferences?
I was a part of several, and I'll echo what your Nashville chapter is doing. If a chapter can at least send a representative, then they'll get a representative sample, and it really does chart the course, because the board of directors takes the lessons learned from that day, and the executive committee, they immediately act on things they can work on, but it sets the course of what the next few years are going to do. They're incredibly important to refocus the society on what it needs to do.
Okay, good. And, there's other SBE issues we can talk about, but let's move to our topic here, which is audio over IP. And this began a discussion. It actually started on Facebook a few days ago, maybe a week or 10 days ago. And let me go find my notes here. Here we go. Where the topic came up about Ethernet switch selection in your audio over IP network. And I'll just start out by saying that, hey, I really guess that in the broadcast world, yours truly was the first guy out there demonstrating audio over IP networks. Now, sure, there was CobraNet and Ethersound before there was LiveWire, but LiveWire was the first one that was actually suitable for broadcasters. It had low latency and was routable, and those others weren't. The folks at Axia, were really hoping to just use CobraNet, and because, hey, the chipsets were available, looked easy to do, relatively, and it just wouldn't work for what broadcasters needed. So the folks at Axia went off and invented LiveWire, and then they found out that it was really important to use multicast. And then to use multicast, there were some key things that had to happen. And we started out using using an HP ProCurve switch, relatively inexpensive switch. $600-$700 or so, and we used that, and it had to be configured. And then we discovered that it didn't scale well. It actually, in the end, we found out that switch, that HP ProCurve switch, did not actually meet its own specifications, especially with regard to IGMP snooping, which is required to manage the what's going on the network. So, we then had to find another switch that did. And it turned out that the Cisco line of switches, the various sizes and of the ones that are meant for multicast, would actually meet their own specs. And we could make them behave perfectly for an AOIP network and scale to a small station or up to many, many, many studios. There's even a facility over in Europe that's got something like 4,000 or 5,000 sources and a couple thousand destinations. So there's a lot of routing going on there with some Cisco switches. We've often received pushback from customers saying, yeah, but we're not a Cisco shop. We're an HP shop. Or we are a give me some other name of some famous switches.
HP. I mean, that's it. One of the next most popular.
HP. But and sorry, Chris.
No, Bay Networks, but that's long gone.
Bay, yeah. Foundry. Yeah, we're a Foundry shop, and we've talked to the people at Foundry, and they say that their switch will do anything a Cisco switch will do. And then we had one broadcaster, big broadcaster, that said, we're going to use Dell switches, and Dell says they check all the boxes. Well, now I'm sure Dell's gotten their switches better, and they did. They checked all the boxes, except that a lot of the functions they performed in software and not at the silicon level. And so what happened was they just broke down. They could not handle properly a full load of multicast streams going on. And they couldn't shut off streams quickly that were no longer being subscribed to. We were back to the Cisco switch thing. And so our answer was always to the broadcaster, don't consider it a Cisco switch. Consider it part. I mean, hey, if we could have rebranded them, we would have. If we could have slapped an Axial label on there, we would have. But don't consider them part. Don't consider them a Cisco switch. Consider them instead part of the Axia system. And you know, once it's configured, your IT people don't have to worry about it. It's probably not even going to be connected to the rest of your IT network. It can silo in its own audio network. If you need access to it, there's other ways to do that, but we don't want you to hook it up to the rest of your network. So therefore, your IT department doesn't have to care about it, even though they really want to. They think it's their domain. And we're welcome to teach them the important things here, but don't let them just start configuring it the way they think it should be, because that will not work, guaranteed, promise you. So that's where I start with on that back in the early days. Things are somewhat better now, and we'll have a lot of suggestions about how to possibly get around the high cost of switches. But I'm going to let Barry and Chris take over now and talk about their experiences, and not just with switches. Barry's got other experience with cheap plastic and metal stuff as well. Tell you what, Barry, why don't you set the stage for it, and then Chris, you'd hop in with your comments and questions.
Well, and thank you for that. The thing that got me thinking along these lines was that Facebook thread that I was sensing the pushback on Cisco switches or infrastructure itself, and that is the life and death of any voice over IP system, whether it's whether it's Weetnet, whether it's Axia. If there's any fault in the network, and it's more than just the switch, but even the Cat 5 or Cat 6 cable that runs between rooms, if you're putting in a system like that, I'll make a couple of things. A few things. One, go with the factory recommended switches every time. And even if you buy your own switches, send them to Telos or send them to Wheatstone and have them configure them. Because then you know it is done from the get-go. And being a Cisco switch, when you get it back, you can always do show running config, and you can learn what they did, which is very helpful, and it taught me a lot about programming Cisco switches. But the other thing is, run new Cat 5s or new Cat 6s. I know you may have lots of cables going into your studio. Run new ones anyway. Just it saves you the hassle. And then the third really important lesson I learned on this thing is patch bays. It's really, really tempting to go on Amazon and get the $8, the $16, 12-port, 16-port, 24-port, 48-port patch bays and be done with it. And that is a recipe for a failure of the system. There's a reason Leviton charges $148 for a 48-port patch bay. And it all involves that connector, the 110 connector on the back. They use better metal. They use better plastic. That's a qualified connector that if you do the twists correctly, it will be true Cat 6. And it's, it doesn't vibrate out of place. And I speak all of this from, it's bit me multiple times. I had a stable system. I saw it operating. It's great until it didn't. And then the whole thing collapsed. And it all in my circumstance, it ended up on patch bays and it ended up with cabling. Ran new cabling, used the better patch bays, and because the switches were already done right. Then everything started just performing. And like I say, this goes to any voice over IP system, not just the one that I have here. We had, when I was with my previous company, we put in Axia at our Atlanta facility, and they learned a lot of good lessons with that I was able to see them learn and take away. So that's been a good thing, but still, it all depends on good infrastructure.
Wow. Yep. Chris?
Well, he said it all. Yes, he's absolutely right. Infrastructure. But we have to remember, and I can speak from experience when I first installed my Axia live wire system at a very large facility in a very small city. And The one thing we researched and realized when we did some of the evaluations of the systems on the market at the time, and talking to those who are using it already, was that you can't approach Ethernet products, IP products, infrastructure, the technology, as we did with, say, your Continental 316 or your BE or the Harris FM25, where the manufacturer did all the work for you and all you had to do was pretty much attach the electrical and RF and hit the plates on or turn on the transmitter nowadays. In the Ethernet world, I keep telling everybody this, and I watch folks get burned. You are now that infrastructure provider. You are now the person that needs to make sure my five nines of reliability for the system have to come from me or, you know, the group. And I use this example many times, and a friend of mine called me up from in Canada and used this example at a meeting, and he laughed and couldn't believe it actually worked. If you want to verify in your office those who take for granted the technology around them, take a phone, type 500 phone, if you're really familiar with that. Okay, it's just a phone with a dial on it, push buttons on it, with a wire coming out the back of the phone. Or it could be your Avaya phone. How about that? How about a Nortel? And place it on the desk in a meeting. Have a conversation with a group of folks. And then stop briefly and go, oh, by the way, could someone call to the lobby? I think we have food coming for today's meeting. That person will grab the phone handset, pick it up, suddenly have an expression of puzzlement. And that's when you realize, oh, yeah, we never ask if the phone has dial tone. We just pick it up because the phone company spent 150 years making sure your expectation, your experience would always be dial tone. That's what voice over IP, audio over IP is about. You need to think in those terms. So when I built the facility, and Kirk always laughs because we did have some problems, but for the most part, it was a flawless installation, but a lot of planning went into it. We made sure that every part of the system had some type of, fault tolerance approach. Yes, we did use Cisco switches. I didn't have an issue with that. I wasn't concerned whether it's Cisco, HP, or Foundry at the time, Brocade, or the others that are out there, Bay Network. Actually, the time of the place I worked at, we did have Bay Networks. We were a Bay Networks house. But my network for the audio over IP was not going on the company LAN or WAN, so I didn't have to worry about it. But what we did do is, as Barry pointed out, we did not do patch bays. We made home runs from each of the studios or each of the positions that had a node connection or router switch possession or connection, whatever you want to call it. And we made sure that when we did the switches, I did it a little differently. The gentleman from Telos, from Axia, insisted that we should be looking at doing these Cisco switches as a virtual IP. So you have four or five switches and using the high-speed backplane, you make it all appear as one virtual IP for the network. Mm. That was my point of failure concern. Think about it. If one of those switches goes out, what happens to the other three or four? They go along with it. So we decided that each studio would have its own dedicated switch, and each switch would talk to the other switch. They'd all have their own IP addresses. Now, on the surface, you may say, well, that's kind of crazy. If you're an IT person, if you're a Cisco engineering certified person, you'd be like, that's wrong. No, let's look at the business we're in. This is not an IT department for a law firm or an engineering firm that's building widgets where you can have a failure and not have an impact on the operation. Radio stations, TV included. So we built these switches. We programmed the switches where individually IP'd, and we bought an extra one that was fully programmed and ready to go. So you could literally take one out, put one in, boop, 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 put your little RJs back into it, and you're up and running. We even tested that theory. We did it in 10 minutes, and we got the studio back online. So those are the things you have to think about. As Barry pointed out, the connectors are key. I've invested in Fluke test equipment for Ethernet installations. I've used on many occasions, most recently at a small building here in New York City, on the 90th floor. We did a 140 runs of Ethernet cables for a RF monitoring and control system. And we used the Fluke testers to make sure that everything passed. One of the groups we worked with did not do that. And we wound up going back into their work of cables and fixing a lot of terminations that were improper. And these are things you have to now think about. And remember, your audio over IP, Wheatstone, Livewire, Ravenna, whomever, it's your network, your infrastructure. So even if your corporation is a HP, not a Cisco house, go pound sand. Build your network. Build your island, just as Barry pointed out. Get the manufacturer specs. Make everything happen. you'll be in better shape. And just remember, it's a new world order.
Well, good deal. Okay. Hey, and Barry, you mentioned earlier sending your Switch off to the manufacturer, to Telos, Wheatstone, whomever, to configure it. And yeah, that is an option. I know the folks at Telos have offered that for a long time. I've got a little different plan. We told you earlier in the show, I tell you how to save money on Switches, because some of these Switches are easily $2,000, $2,500, $3,000, $3,500 for a brand new Cisco Switch that's maybe big enough to be your core Switch in your facility, or one of your core Switches. And the little stations that I am part owner of, we that'd be a lot of money for us. So I go on eBay, I find used, off-lease, refurbed Cisco Switches, typically a $2,960 for a smaller facility, or a 3650 or a 3570 for a larger facility, or even a 4800 series. So these get bigger and bigger as I'm going up with the numbers here. And honestly, I'll try to buy two of them, because they're pretty cheap. I mean, anywhere from under $100 to $200 or $300 is what we've been paying for them. And so I'll get, if I need one, I'll buy two, because they're cheap. And even both of them together are, you know, less than a fourth the cost of a new one. And so I'll take these, and I've gotten to where I can follow the directions I find online to wipe them clean so that they're factory fresh, just like new, totally wiped clean. And then I hook them up to a computer here at my office that has a USB to serial adapter, because a lot of these older ones just have the console connection, which is serial. And then I'll call my buddies at Telos support, and I'll say, hey, I've got a Switch I need you to configure. I need the first 40 ports to be access ports. In other words, we're going to hook devices to them. And I want the last 8 ports to be trunk ports, so that I'll hook, you know, perhaps other Switches to them in a bigger facility. And then I give them an IP address for that Switch, and I give them my desired password. And literally in 10, 15 minutes, it's done. One of the telesupport people will go in there, and they'll configure the Switch, and they'll test it, and by golly, they'll save it. They'll save the configuration, which has been forgotten from time to time by folks like me. And yeah, like, hey, it worked until we lost power, and then when it booted back up, yeah, it didn't work again. Well, that's because you didn't save the configuration.
Because you didn't say write memory.
Ah, there you go. Yeah, save write memory. So my point is, hey, I have configured these Switches myself with instructions on the Telos website, and maybe other manufacturers provide this too. Hey, if you're doing a 2960 Switch, here's what you type in to the command line. But, you know, I don't want to fat finger something and get it wrong. So, you know, the guys in support, at least the Telos and probably others too, you know, they copy paste, or they just do it from memory because they're so good. And then they test their configuration, and bam. So that's how you, save money. I've never paid more than $200 for an Ethernet switch at any of my stations, and get it configured correctly for absolutely free. All you have to do is hook it up to get a serial connection, at least on the older ones. I think the newer ones you can do with Ethernet connections now, but the older switches are all serial port from the console connection. Barry, is that good advice?
Every bit of it. And it's, I found my IT group turned me on to a local refurbisher where I've gotten all my switches at, you know, the same kind of deal that you're getting. It's really excellent. I've gotten, you know, nice 3750s or, you know, 2960s from these guys for just a fraction of them, already cleaned, already factory set up. And you sit down there, and, you know, and to Chris's point about having a spare, and your point about having a spare one, I've done the same thing. I've got a fully configured spare switch for the Axia network, which I've got a VX and an iProfiler system, and a fully, you know, configured and set up Wheatnet switch for that I can throw into maybe not as fast as Chris can for 10 minutes, but certainly quickly, certainly within, you know, 15 to 20 to change all those connections out. But it makes all the difference in the world. But while I have the mic, I do want to say, Chris, I am incredibly jealous you got to work on that 90th floor project. I am incredibly jealous. That sounded like a huge and a fun deal.
Oh, it is. I'm actually, it's still continuing. I'm still doing weekend work with it. Climbing around and doing a lot of RF and the Ethernet stuff. Just as a reminder, we're talking Ethernet switches in an audio over IP or VoIP systems as well. Those are known as managed switches. There's a reason why the word managed appears before the word Ethernet switch. And if you are working at a facility and you're buying the $60 Linksys/Cisco home office switches, which are great, they're not managed. So the idea is port one gets a blast of packets that find their way across to ports 1 through 8. You do a multicast on that, and you've just crashed the box. So understand these little things, because just back, going back earlier when I said what we used to do with transmitters and stuff, when you built a facility, did you not buy 2 transmitters? Did you not buy 2 audio processors? Did you not buy 2 STL microwave links, if it was Mosley 606Cs, or maybe the earlier ones, or maybe you had T1s that were the old Troutons, and, the Intraplexes. You always bought 2. So why wouldn't you buy 2 Ethernet switches, one as a backup? See, there's a different discipline in the world of IT today. That's why you need to apply our broadcast disciplines. As I used to tell a friend of mine when I worked at a facility, our IT folks were called BITS, Broadcast IT Services. We had a lot of bits running around, but it worked.
Hey, you're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 394th episode. Along with us today, Chris Tobin is in New Jersey, and I'm here in Nashville. And Barry Thomas is our guest. He's in Denver. We're talking about making sure when you do your audio over IP infrastructure, and if you haven't, you will. And that's just where we are today. And by the way, if you haven't done it, you're going to enjoy it, because when you get figured out and get it working, it's a joy to work on. I'll tell you some stories later on, maybe a different episode, about virtualizing your machines. At one of our stations clusters, we are throwing hardware out the back door. Why? Because we have virtualized now, so far 6 machines in a heavy duty, server that we got off lease, refurbished. And it's got a duplicate just like it as a backup. So we're finally getting into that world, even in a very small market. So This Week in Radio Tech is the show. Our show is brought to you in part by Suncast. I'm sorry, I forgot which ad you're going to play first. Why don't you just play it, and I'll talk about it. Go ahead.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavvo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual-mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes, and enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavvo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavvo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavvo radio tech at www.lavvo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavvo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. They help make it possible for us to bring the show to you week after week. We got bills here, too. In fact, I just had to pay another year worth of web hosting for our own website. So thanks a lot to Lavvo, and also to any of the sponsors who take care of us, and we appreciate if you take care of them. Lavvo.com/twert. You're watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode 394, with Barry Thomas is here, and also Chris Tobin, of course. We're talking about audio over IP infrastructure, and of course, switches are an easy thing to harp on and issue advice on. So we've got that. We also have the issue of the other infrastructure. That is the wiring that Barry alluded to earlier, and even patch panels. Now, I got to say, in my small stations, I've never used Ethernet patch panels. I realize that's part of structured cabling, but, you know, sometimes small stations, we don't do structured cabling. We don't have that much of it to do. So we just pretty much pull wires directly, you know, attach them to the racks nicely and try to route them nicely to the front of the switches. And then in the rooms, pull them out of a box in the wall and take them directly to the devices they serve. So there's really no other infrastructure, cabling infrastructure, structured wiring in between. But if you're doing that a lot, you can't do that at a large facility. You've got to do it right. You've got to have systems in place and patching to keep things neat and orderly and to have backup and reserves. So, Barry, I wonder if you might talk to us a bit about what you alluded to earlier with you mentioned the name Leviton and their patch panels. You're going to have to explain a bit because I'm unfamiliar.
Well, if you look on, say, again, there's an amazing amount of things I get from Amazon to supply our radio station anymore, because you can basically get anything from there. But if you literally, if you go through there, or you go through the Gray Bar catalog, or any of those, there are the, you know, the $8 24-port switches and the $16 ones, and then there's this big gap to Leviton or, you know, any of the higher line patch bays. And it's not apparent why there's a difference, but boy, there is. And I was saying before, it has to do with that connector on the back. When you punch it down to there's a 110 punch for all the Cat 5s on the back. The cheap patch bays are maybe good for one punch. Mm-hmm. And then after a certain amount of time, they're going to start failing anyway, and call it the quality of the metal they're using, you know, and the quality of the plastic that goes on either, you know, that holds the wire on either side on a 110, a name brand expensive patch bay will hold that thing for years. I've got a facility here that, I had one room where we moved another radio station in, and I moved that station into what was then a production room. And that room became problematic network-wise. And the only reason was that the wiring was disturbed. We didn't change any punches, didn't do anything, just the wiring got moved. And it was cheap patch bays that did it. The way you do using home runs, RJ45s to RJ45s, that's definitely a way to do it. But like you said, the bigger the facility, the harder it's going to be to do that. Cause you need, like you said, backup, you need organization. But it does add another set of points of failure. So you cannot overlook that while, an occasional dropout might be okay on a business network, on an audio over IP network where multicast and streaming are important and every bit is important. If you've got a switch that where you've got one pair of the Cat 5s that are intermittent, you can have a switch going 100 megabit, 1 gig, 100 megabit, 1 gig, just back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah.
Just by one of the signal pairs that tells the switch to go to 1 gig. And even though it will test out, it's passing data, but it's not letting the switch go to 1 gig. And again, you can start hearing pops on the air because it's just running out of bandwidth.
Good point. Excellent point. Chris Tobin, you've got a little story to tell on this topic as well.
Well, yeah, I I did a project years ago at a facility where they had an outside contractor install the Ethernet infrastructure, Cat 5E, whatever it was at the time. And then the radio station brought in the audio over IP product and plugged everything in and thought they were great. And then started discovering issues with programming and dropouts and all kinds of strange things. It turned out that the installers were not told or asked to certify all the terminations, as I mentioned earlier. And as a result, they discovered that about 5% of the connections, the terminations, did not meet the TIA specs for CAT. for the category cabling. And as a result, the audio over AP had lots of errors that were being induced. So the sad part is we were chasing our tails thinking that the switches were in trouble or some of the end devices may have been at fault. Nobody thought to ask about the actual wiring in between. So we started troubleshooting and discovered that. So to Barry's point, you need to make sure you pay attention to the details. Do not go for the cheapest thing. There's a reason why when you attend a Steve Lampin session, seminar, whatever you want to call it, he goes to great lengths to explain the need for reliable terminations and reliable terminator devices. And in Belden world, if you've ever worked with any of the Belden engineers or projects involving their products, the one term they'll always come to you with is a first pass yield, which is it's the termination reliability factor. So you have 100 connectors, and out of those connectors, you may have two or three that fail or one. Then that means the yield is less than 100%, not acceptable for many people. And in the case of broadcast, that's important because if you've got several dozen studios you're working with, or who knows, several floors between the studios, you suddenly rack up those first pass field failures, and you're gonna have a lot of extra work to do. And a lot of folks don't realize these little details, but I've had probably 90% of the time when I get a call from somebody asking for help, the first thing I ask them now is who put the wires in, what method did they use, and let's take a look at them. And remember, an Ethernet cable is an RF connection. It's an RF termination. That's right. Remember the frequencies it's operating at? 350 megs, 1 gig, 10 gig. That's an RF. Therefore, the application or the understanding of standing waves now plays a part. Proper terminations. What happens when you do an inch and 5/8 termination on a 20 kilowatt transmitter? It's not exactly where the bullet should be. That's a hot spot. Sometimes it explodes. Think of it in Ethernet worlds. You can actually burn out the ports on your switches if there's too much standing waves. That I know for a fact because I worked at a facility where we had that problem. We were replacing these terminations on the wall, the little patch bay type terminations they mount on the wall. You've seen them. And we couldn't figure out why the equipment, the switch, everything was just failing until one day we opened up the box and looking at the actual circuit board. And you could see the little bolums, the transformers, and they were brown. Discolored. Send them back to the manufacturer, and they called up. They said, are you guys having issues with your wiring? Because you're burning out the inputs. And that's something else you need to keep in mind. So, yes, you're dealing with a lot of different things these days with Ethernet. It's not just a simple pick up the cable, plug it in, and go. And so consider those thoughts. Do research. Make sure you do it right. And there's a reason why some of those connectors from AMP or Leviton and others have special tools and make the terminations, because the twists have to be as close as possible to that termination.
Barry, you mentioned the name Leviton earlier, and I was curious about is that the name brand typically to go with for structured wiring and your cable? Are there other really trusted brands?
There are, but they're not coming to mind right now, because Leviton's the one that I've used the most, and they have well qualified wiring systems. Panduit, I don't think they're, and someone's going to correct me on this, I'm sure. I'm not sure Panduit goes all the way down to the connector level, but they have everything but I may be wrong. But at the connector level, Leviton's been a constant for me. While I've got the mic, Chris brought up Steve Lampin's seminars. If you have a chance to ever see that, or if you can get your SBE chapter to bring Steve Lampin from Belden in there, you will learn more about wiring. And this sounds like a dry subject, but he does such an incredible job. And you will know more about why wiring is and connectorization is important and how certain decisions are made. And you'll just be so much more educated about how to deal with wiring. And it's also, he's actually an incredible speaker.
Yeah, he's good.
Oh yeah, and
go ahead, Chris.
No, he's he's good. He did a presentation last September up in Canada at a place I attended a conference, and he discussed RF, demonstrated what he did back at the Belden plant, and using vice grips, piece of coax, Belden coax, of course, and pinching the wire and demonstrating what it does to the return losses using a scope, a spectrum, and everything. You sit there and go, wow, so you could actually do that to the cable and still not impact anything. And then he showed the same thing for AES audio cables. He goes, look, you can spend $600 on this 10-foot length and get the best digital audio you think. Or you could buy our Belden for far less and still twist it and pinch it and get the same results. That's his type of presentation. And trust me, they're based in fact. There is no he presents the numbers and he'll put it to you and you can challenge him and he will come back. It's well worth it.
I wish
he's
I could remember
the Bill Nye of the wiring world.
Yes, yes, he is. Yes. I wish I could remember the where I saw this exactly, but the famous author who wrote books about troubleshooting, you know, his mantra was always, when you have a problem with a system, the first thing you check is the cables, the interconnecting cables. That's the first thing, because he said well over 50% of the time, he said, in my experience, closer to 80% of the time, the problem that you have is the interconnecting cables. And I would have to say that with IT systems, that's true. And, you know, when you make a big honking RF connection, like you mentioned, inch and 5/8 a minute ago, you put that on, and if it's mechanically sound, it's probably going to work right. But when you're crimping 8 conductors into an RJ45 connector, you're not, you know, you crimp it, everything looks okay, but did they really bite? Did they make proper connection? Or if you pull it just a little, is it making connection by just a few little molecules touching each other? And of course you could use testers to help test these things out. You can wiggle them, but I don't know. There's always a little bit of an unknown factor there about, is this right and how long is it going to last? And is something going to cause it to fail? Point being, use the good stuff. I recently built our station in Samoa last August, I believe it was. And honestly, I forgot to take any really quality connectors with me. Of all things, right there on the island, they had those platinum brand, where the, you know, the wires go through the RJ45. You get the special crimp tool. It cuts them off. Well, there was a store there on the island, Island Electronics, that sold those connectors and the crimp tool for them. And I had zero trouble. And it just, everything just worked. And I have a lot of confidence in the quality of the terminations there. But that is the first thing to check is this cable any good? And if you wiggle it, obviously you can have troubles.
And to speak to your concern with the connectors, make sure that the connectors you purchase and the wire you purchase are matched. You don't use stranded wire on a connector that looks for solid wire, and you don't do the opposite. And I've seen people do that and say, look, it works just fine. No, you will run into problems.
Yeah, one jiggle and there it goes.
Yeah. Hey, earlier you guys mentioned the example of taking a Continental transmitter, and it comes ready to be a transmitter. You plug it in, you hook the wires up, and there's not a lot of configuration to do. Although I remember I put a Nautel transmitter in some years ago, and I found out that if you don't remove the shorting clips on the meters that they ship them with, the meters don't read very much. But what I was going to point out is this is actually a topic that I wrote on a white paper for this past NAB, the difference between purpose-built and general purpose. So for, you know, if you buy, for example, if you buy an SAS audio router, that's purpose-built. It's designed to do that job and do it extraordinarily reliably. But an SAS audio router makes a terrible Ethernet switch because it's not. It's an audio router, and it does that one job very, very well. Well, an Ethernet switch, you know, around the world, they make a lot of them. Even a single company like Cisco makes a lot of them. They've gotten to where they're making them very, very well and extraordinarily reliable, but they're for general purpose data. Now, if you want to move audio, your specialized data through there that needs a little special care, then you're going to have to configure that switch. And so, we can make a computer. We can go buy a computer for $500 from Best Buy, a Windows 10 machine from, you know, Dell or whomever, and put it on the desk. And that computer can be an automation system, you know, with some configuration. Or it can be an asterisk PBX. It can be a lot of different things. But you have to configure it. Same thing for Ethernet switches that are going to do something somewhat specialized, and that is route audio. And hey, all this is becoming more commonplace as the whole television world is moving to the standard of video over IP and SMPTE 2110-30 standard. then, you know, we're going to find so much more gear that is just ready to go or closer to ready to go. But I just want to address, I think about, you know, why do I have to configure it? Well, because we're doing something a little special with it. Hey, we've got a topic to talk about in a minute, and that's about this this dish registration thing. But before we do, let's see, is there anything else on the topic of AOIP infrastructure and doing it right so it doesn't come back to bite you in the behind before we go? Barry or Chris, did you have any more thoughts on that you want to pass along?
Just do your research.
I think we've covered it. It covered most of it. Do you have anything, Chris?
I say just research what you're going to do. I've worked with Livewire. I've worked with the Ravenna and the Wheatnet. And I can tell you that all three systems can be implemented in various ways, and they all take a different approach. And I did a Wheatnet install, and I have to say the guys there were really good and helpful and explained why you don't want to take this approach. It works well with another protocol, but not this one because of the way they took their approach to implement it. So research what it is you're going to do. So whatever system you choose to go with, make sure that you understand what the manufacturer has designed and how they designed it. And also, as Kirk pointed out earlier, and Barry, you know, if you send the switch to them to configure, that's all well and good, but make sure you get a copy of the config file. Make sure you save it in a place that you can find it. Maybe on an SD card taped to the top of the switch. You know, if you're going to do, if you do, say, Cisco switches that are using the serial ports or the blue cable, that's a serial cable. Yes, it is wired different than others. Do not assume that they're all the same. Put the two of them together in a bag and attach that to the back of the switch or in the rack.
Yeah.
So when you're going to work, because you're not going to use that blue cable anywhere else except with those switches. These are things you think about now, because when the day comes at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday and there's a problem, you're going to be scrambling in that office for that little cable to plug into your laptop. Oh, I don't have my USB to DB9 adapter either. Keep them together. I can go to my desk right now and I have a little plastic bag that has null modem, USB to DB9, the blue cable, a homemade loopback tester, a little DB connector with 2 and 3 pins tied together. Why would you want to do something as silly as that? Well, here, you plug in your laptop, you fire up whatever terminal software you'd like to use, say PPTY, and or party that is, and all of a sudden you say, is this all configured right? You plug it into the end of that DB9 on the USB, type in a few characters on the keyboard, it echoes back, you're good. Now you know your laptop is talking to the outside world. Now take that blue cable, plug it into your switch, hit a command key stroke. Hey, nothing's happening. You know your computer's okay. You don't have to waste time with that. Now you could look at the switch. Little details. And Barry knows darn well what I'm talking about because he's been down this road.
Oh, you know it. And it's funny, back in, you know, how long time ago we all used to have our little, you know, editing kit, our, you know, with the splicing block and the razor blades and the grease pencil. Instead of that, now we carry around these little kits like you're talking about, Chris, with the serial adapter and the null modem and the, you know, and the blue Cisco cable and a serial extension. That's our go-to now.
Yeah, it's important to have that and keep it with the gear that you're working with. Don't do like everybody used to do traditionally. Oh, it goes back to the shop or we put it up on the shelf and the blue, those go in the blue containers, but the yellow are for this and the reds are for that. No, stop that. Okay, just stop it. If you're doing that, throw them out. Make the kits, label them in little boxes and do it properly. You laugh, but I have worked in places and Barry knows.
I don't disagree. I have learned this hard lesson the hard way too.
He knows. He worked at a place that's very familiar with a nice wood grain credenza. It's very nice, well made by the carpenter shop. But everybody wanted everything in little boxes so they could always unpack it and then go and pack it together when they went to go somewhere. Don't do that. It wastes time, especially when you're in critical moments, you know, critical mission moment. Just saying.
We've got more of This Week in Radio Tech coming up, including what we're going to talk about. Our last little topic is, you run a radio station, or you're an engineer for a station. You've got a bunch of satellite receivers for your news, your sports, your regional sports, whatever it may be, maybe the Rush Limbaugh show or your overnight programming. Yeah, all that could go away, and you may not have any recourse unless you do the following. And the following is coming right up right now, this word from the Telus Alliance and the Infinity IP Intercom.
Hi, I'm Martin Deister, Vice President of Business Development and Product Director for Telus Infinity IP Intercom System. Telus Infinity is different to any other intercom system because it's the first IP intercom system that doesn't have a matrix. Great communication within the broadcast environment is essential to TV and radio production. With Telos Infinity, you can link all your production crew, whether it's the director in the production control room, sound guy in the booth, boom operator on the floor, your anchors in the studio, presenters out in the field, weatherman, even your weatherman. Production staff listening to communications audio are hearing crystal clear sounds. It means the nuances of the people communicating with them can be heard all the time. Everything is crystal clear and accurate. The master intercom panels that we've created include multicolor LCD switches. You can use color coding to group IFBs, to group production crew members, your remotes, anybody else. Matrix-free intercom means low cost of entry, low cost of design, low cost of installation from the get-go. With Telos Infinity, you start saving money the moment you install it, and you continue to save money for the life of the product. The same benefits that broadcasters all around the world have found by using audio over IP now apply to intercom for the very first time. Never before have you been able to communicate using program quality audio simply by connecting two devices into a network switch. It truly is plug and play. Programming an intercom system has never been easier than it is with Telos Infinity. With our advanced dashboard programming utility, you can have your intercom system out of the box and up and running in record time. I'm Martin Deister, inviting you to visit telosalliance.com to learn more about Telos Infinity Broadcast Optimized Intercom System, the first matrix-free IP intercom system optimized for broadcast.
And don't think it's just for television, because radio stations can use intercom too. In fact, as far as I know, the very first IP-based intercom from Infinity is going into a radio station in the U.S. So the very first radio one, the very first one. Okay, anyway, we're putting one in, and it's pretty cool. I can't wait to go there and see just how they're using it. It's a good-sized news, talk, and sports facility, but it's going to go in there. And they're already using Axia there, so yeah, that narrows it down a little bit. So there you go. Also, I want to point out that Chris Tobin and I got to use the IP intercom at the NAB show during a video production that we did. And, we say it's program quality. It's, 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. Chris, I was flabbergasted at the quality of the audio over the intercom. It was like you were right there.
Oh, it was great. I enjoyed it. I mean, I've used many intercom systems, but that one was excellent. I was able to whisper, and the camera operators could still hear me quite clearly. I liked the way it set up very easily, and was even more fun was watching the daisy chain of them with an Ethernet cable. I'm like, oh, this is interesting. We're not doing the voltages and all the crazy stuff. It's just PoE, which is standard, but everything was just data right across. So any one of these little headsets could be rearranged and whatever we have to do very easily. I thought it was great.
Yeah, and that daisy chain was cool. It cut down on the wiring. We just daisy chained from one camera to the next, and everything had their own IP address. So there's actually a little switch, a little Ethernet switch built in to each of the belt packs. So that's pretty cool. Thanks a lot to Telos and the Telos Alliance for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech and the Infinity IP intercom system. It's really, really cool. You're going to be hearing more about that as it finds application, certainly in television. And even some in radio, theater as well. If you run a theater company, hey, it's great for that too, because it just runs over your network like we've been talking about. Okay, let's real quick turn our attention to satellite dishes. We've been hearing from Westwood One put out a memo to all their affiliates this past week. Also, I know that Munn Reese consulting engineers and other consulting engineers as well put out memos saying, hey, if your receive dish isn't registered, you could have a real problem. And before the show, you guys were talking about that. Hey, you've always been it's always been a good idea to register your receive dish location. And as a small market operator, I'm going, huh? What? It's a radio. Shouldn't I be able to just, pick it, receive? Why should I have to worry about somebody interfering? Isn't that the FCC's job? Okay, where am I going wrong here? I guess these frequencies are reused, huh? Chris?
I'll pick that one up if you want. The thing is, and this, we kind of went through this with the FCC through their effort to get stations to register the receive sites for their 2 gig and their 950 links. If they don't know what's being received or where it's being received, they don't know how to protect you. And this is going to be one of those cases. Chris and I both worked in network radio before, And both of us have been faced with situations like this, and registering your downlink has always been a good idea. The biggest impediment to that has been, the $1,500 or more to do a free frequency coordination report with ComSearch or someone like that. And then the complexity of doing that, and the time frame and the mailings and all of that. In the April 19th public notice from the FCC, they have waived that requirement, which is a huge deal. The fact that it's really down to just the filing fee, just to protect yourself. Yeah, I understand this is, people have characterized this as a money grab, but this is something we need to do to protect our sites, at the very minimum, protect our sites from the inevitable sharing of just about every frequency out there.
Wow.
Yeah, that's true. People have to remember, broadcasters have to remember that the spectrum, the wireless spectrum across every frequency, not just broadcast, and broadcast auxiliary services and a few other frequencies that we all have access to, or at least we like to, are open. It's open territory. And depending on who has the strongest lobbying group will get what they want. If there's no activity that can be proven by paper, say registration, then guess what? They're going to be encroaching in that area. Now, let me read this little statement. The commission seeks comment on the use of 3.7, 4.2 gigahertz bands for mobile wireless broadband. Now, that should be a flag for you right now when I say 3.7 to 4.2. Why? That's your LNB's downlink. So if you're a Westwood One affiliate, you're going to have problems trying to receive your favorite show. And remember this. This, what I'm reading to you, is coming from a proceeding that was submitted to the commission, comments from a small business called T-Mobile USA. They're petitioning for expanding the flexible use of the mid-spectrum between 3.7 and 24 gigahertz. And the FCC is calling that CBRS, the Citizens Band Radio Service. And we're not talking 26 megahertz. Register. Make sure you're protected. So if T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, or anybody else, wireless services, puts up a link between two points in your neighborhood and happens across your satellite path, you can at least argue and protect yourself. If you don't have it registered, you're going IP with that network distribution.
So if you are a Westwood One affiliate, and a lot of radio stations across the country are, you probably have a memo in your hand from Eric Weiler, the Senior VP of Technology and Operations. Eric really spells this out just exactly what both of you said, and points out that this is FCC Form 312. You can use the paper form, or you can do this online. And the URL is given in his memo. We'll put that in the show notes here for you. Or you can, of course, engage a third party to file this for you. A lot of consulting engineers do this. Certainly, a satellite engineering group is recommended by Eric Weiler as a group that does this. And there is that filing fee. It's $435 for the filing fee. Now, a little group like mine, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 satellite dishes in 4 towns in the poorest part of Mississippi. And so I'm not real excited about spending over $1,700 in filing fees just to let the FCC know. Yeah, of course we're receiving the signal that's coming into our backyard. Duh. Why would you want to screw with that? And I realize that transmissions are directional and receiving can be directional too. And so I realize that there, RF in these bands could go on without interference, as long as it wasn't in the vicinity of being in front of our dish. I realized that could be reused. It just seems like such a bad idea. I'm sorry this is like new to me. I'm sure it's new to a lot of small market broadcasters. You guys are up on this and why it's important, but it comes as a big shock. And, $1,700, a little hard to scrape up for small broadcasters four dishes.
Yeah, no, the reason it's a shock to everybody, and it's sad but true, and Barry knows this from working in the same office as I've been in at network radio level, a lot of folks have taken for granted for the last 20 years, broadcasters have thought or have felt that their spectrum that they use, in this case downlinks from the satellite, has been protected by just default, by the fact that the broadcast. The reality is the cellular services, or the, oh no, sorry, I won't say cellular, the mobile data services have found that a lot of the spectrum they want to use, nobody's been paying attention to because it's not on, it's not written. They know it's used. They know there's people out there doing it. However, they're going to stick to the facts. There's no record of it. Therefore, why can't we go there? And that's what this comment, this what I just read to you partly, was pretty much saying to the FCC. Hey, folks, here's some spectrum we found. We've been monitoring it in this part of the region, and there's no activity that we're aware of. And according to the database, there's nothing there. Meanwhile, I'm sure they did it in a place that's probably got 27 downlinks for 13 different radio networks. But without the database, there's no protection. Yeah. And that's what we're up against. The fact that we've just pretty much had security through obscurity.
I would point out, okay, so where are these frequencies being used by broadcasters? Anywhere there's a radio station, probably in, you know, thousands of markets across the country. Okay, so where T-Mobile or Google or whoever wants to grab some of the spectrum and use it for data retransmission or delivery, where do you want to use this? Because the places where you want to deliver to, guess what? There's nobody there. You know, I mean, because there's no radio station. There's probably very few bodies there. Maybe that's the best place to, you know, to distribute on these frequencies. But it just seems backwards. Protect my receiver. Let's see. The transmitter's already licensed. The coverage area is defined. That's where you can't interfere. It boggles my mind to think that it's not that way, but it's not that way.
It's not how the rules are set up. The rules don't protect receivers. They protect transmitters. They protect in that fashion. And also remember, 3.5 gig service is what's coming open, and it just happens to be adjacent to another part of spectrum that you'd love to see an aggregate of, because the new thing now is carrier aggregation. And the 3.5 spectrum allows for some interesting local backhaul, or actually take it back, front haul solutions for the carriers.
I have a perfect solution. I hear Barry grumbling like he wants to say something. Here's the perfect solution.
No. And the thing is that we've lived through this on the 2 gig spectrum. The SBE has fought long and hard because that was the first place people were trying to go. There was a company trying to do a trucker's television network over 2 gig. And after that, AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, all the big carriers were going after 2 gig. And that's where your radio, your television station, mobile trucks are. You know, where your eye in the skies are. They're all in 2 gig. And everyone thought, oh, well, broadcasters are not registering their sites, so that must not be used. So anyone with a 2 gig RPU or a remote pickup site, really, if you're not registering, had not registered those, you are probably getting walked on by mobile.
I guess I related back to terrestrial broadcast. My FM transmitter is licensed by the FCC, but not one of my listeners is licensed. I have a radio here. Don't interfere with my favorite radio station. Well, duh, the transmitter is licensed to cover this particular area. And no, you can't transmit on the same frequency in that area. That's how FM works. That's how AM works. That's how TV works. Right. Why doesn't satellite work the same way?
Because the satellite link is not to the common public.
And the footprints is the nation of satellites.
So there's radio stations all across the nation picking up Westwood One, for example, or Premier.
Right. The fixed satellite services, the FSS, is a business link. Therefore, it's treated in that fashion. That's how it operates. It's not a receiver, commonplace receiver as your FM or AM. So we're using it for business. It's an actual point-to-point. So it's the same way cellular does their thing. They're not going to protect their individual user's phone, but they will protect their receive sites at their cellular towers in order to make things work. So the same thing for us. And Barry's absolutely right. The 2 gig BAS project, as it was called, it was an absolute wake-up call that nobody paid attention to. And most TV broadcasters, and I fault the industry, just let it go. They just took the money and ran, and found out 2 years later they had to invest in a completely new system. And they were like belly aching. I was like, guys, no one's paying attention. this is happening again. This is even worse because there's more satellite receivers than there are.
You know, I hate to say, but we got to go. If Suncast could stay with us and we could each just, you know, pull up a couple of beers, we could probably stay here all night and solve all the problems.
Yeah. I mean, there's no easy solution, but definitely register, get the database full, and it may hold off people.
Well, you know, just like we shouldn't complain about the cost of a switch that's important, we shouldn't complain about the cost of protecting what we receive. And we now, thanks for helping me understand that. I appreciate it. Barry Thomas has been our guest today for the last hour from Denver, Colorado. Barry, where are you at nowadays?
I am at the Kroenke Sports and Entertainment Radio Group. We've got, he owns among other things, the LA Rams, but we got a little group of four stations here in Denver, and we're part of his media group.
Cool. So you spend your time engineering and keeping, not only keeping stations going, but handling sports network operations.
We have a little sports radio network. Our our video network is handled out of Centennial, and we've got a number of cable channels. The Outdoor Network is and Altitude Sports Network that carries the Nuggets and the Colorado Avalanche. But we've also got own some teams. We've got the Rapids and the Nuggets and the Avs and the Mammoth, which is the rugby team. So we're all about sports, which is kind of ironic that I'm involved in it.
Well, good deal. Hey, Barry, you've done an awful lot, and thanks for bringing your expertise to the show. Hope to have you on again sometime.
Thank you. And if you can indulge me a second, especially coming up to Mother's Day this weekend, when you posted your tease about this site, I have to say my mom is my biggest cheerleader. So I have to do a typical hi, mom, to Becky Anderson in Columbia, South Carolina, because I know you're watching. And thank you. And I'll talk to you Sunday.
Oh, that's great. And hey, my word out to Becky Anderson is you done good, mom. And so thanks a lot, Barry, for being with us. Chris Tobin, thank you for being with us as well.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. It's always good to see friends.
Yep, sure is. And I'll say hi to my mom too. Hi, mom. My mom's up in Louisville, Kentucky. So good to have you. She watches the show occasionally. She doesn't understand much of it, but that's okay. Her son's on it. All right, we got to go. We got a guest next week. I believe it's Josh Bone of Bone Broadcast, and he's got some great ideas for doing remote broadcasts. Very important in today's social media world to be really in touch with your listeners and your viewers, as the case may be. I want to thank Suncast for switching and producing today's show. Thank you very much, Suncast, for a stellar job. And thanks to Andrew Zarian for starting the GFQ Network. We appreciate you as well. We're going to see you next week. So tell your friends, and remember, we post the show later on YouTube, so it's there forever. Thanks a lot to our sponsors, Lavo at lavo.com/twert, and also the Telos Alliance with the new Infinity IP intercom system. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.